They waited behind the rock ridge as the sun went down. When the light faded and the gaudy stars emerged in their millions, torches flared in the Dalasifa village. Michael looked up over the ridge and saw a group of robed Dalasifa standing around what appeared to be a rectangular pit dug into the earth near the waterhole. It looked to him, from this distance at least, that two figures were balanced on some kind of beam across the pit and were grappling with each other.
What's going on down there?
I'm not sure. A celebration of some kind?
A sporting contest. Maybe they're gambling on who's going to win.
Well, we're going to win.
You can't be serious about walking in there without a gun. Even you Englishers can't be that insane.
I was born in Russia. I can promise you that I'll be attracting all the attention, but you'll have to be fast and careful getting across the wire. Find that weapons tent as quickly as you can. And if you have the chance and means, blow it to blazes. Take care of the boy and take care of yourself.
They'll kill you first thing. You'll never even get down to the wire before you're dead.
I say you will. Look for your opportunity and take it.
Michael stood up and started down on the other side. He didn't look back. He reached the bottom of the ridge and began walking directly toward the watchman's tower. The watchman had a small oil lamp up there, and a torch had been set beside the entrance to the village through the barbed wire. It was the watchman's horn. It seemed the party was over.
Or perhaps it is just about to begin.
The robed watchman came down a ladder, pointing a rifle at Michael Gallatin's midsection.
Minhu ada is al hasbika.
Michael got an expression of semi-comprehension from the watchman. Within a few seconds, other Dalasifa came running to answer the call of the horn. Pistols and rifles, British, German, and Italian, were in evidence. Some of the robed men carried torches or oil lamps. They got around Michael to keep him from advancing or retreating. A figure in crimson robes pushed his way through the growing crowd. He got up close to Michael and stopped. A man had arranged his keffiyeh into a turban, revealing a handsome, though somewhat vulpine, face. A pair of black eyes under thick black brows glowered at him. He was in his mid-30s, his flesh burnished dark brown. He had high cheekbones and a long, elegant nose that any high-bred Englisher might have envied. In some other world, the man in the crimson robes could have been a Libyan film star. He was cleanly shaven and bore in his deep-set eyes a sharp and cunning intelligence.
Brit.
An English uniform, yes.
Brit.
He tapped his chest.
Nuri, meaning fire.
Interesting.
Who is you?
Me? I am the devil, and I've come to destroy you.
Destroy me? Say you devil, yet you know not my speech. How is this?
Everyone knows the devil is an Englishman.
Nuri examined Michael's bruised face and swollen left eye at a distance of a few inches. He looked at the arm in the sling.
You no devil. You hurt. Maybe crazy-headed fool.
This is my disguise. My mask.
The fireman reached under his robe and brought out a knife with a curved blade. He put it to Michael's jawline.
Nuri, cut your mask off. Then know your real face.
I've come all the way from hell, Nuri. A long way. Won't you show me a little of your village before I destroy you?
Nuri lowered the knife and grinned.
All hell. Everywhere. Me, king of hell. Me, king of all devils. You only fool with madness here.
Nuri touched his own skull with the handle of his knife.
Where you from come? Do not know. Where you go? Nuri do know.
Nuri turned and walked away, and Michael was prodded by a gun barrel and made to follow him. He was stopped somewhere within the village. Torches and oil lamps ringed him. The guns were everywhere, and they were all pointed at him.
Village mine. People mine. Nuri rules here. You say different, devil?
I say Nuri will soon be on his knees. I say Nuri will soon be begging for mercy.
Devil, meet my son.
A boy of about 14 appeared, hobbling on sticks covered with gauze bandages, likely scavenged from a dead medic's pack. The boy, wearing a loosely fitting white shirt and a pair of red-dyed trousers, resembled his father. Except his right leg was gone at the hip, and there was only enough remaining of his left foot to grip a small piece of ground. It was really the shape of a cloven hoof. Michael recognized the injury. It was what happened when you stepped on a mine.
Hasib mine, eldest son, such pride. bride. His handsome boy. Say, speak, devil.
The boy stared at Michael with as much hatred as Michael had ever dreaded to see. If this boy had a gun, the little play would be over. Michael knew this boy. He knew him well. This boy was every sufferer that war had made, every orphan, every widow or widower, every amputee, every brutalized corpse in a shallow ditch, every piece of flesh that used to be a man, every silent scream. He knew this boy well, and he felt terror to his soul.
Oh, handsome.
Ah, thank you, sir.
Michael felt a night breeze blow past, and he smelled the enticing perfume of the waterhole. The urge to drink fell upon him, and still stunned by this vision of war's corruption, he was seized by a moment of rare weakness.
I would like some water.
Thirsty is the devil. How this? Drink.
Hands grasped Michael by the arms and half pushed, half dragged him along. The entire Dalasifa nation seemed to be out in force, and like a sea in the desert, they moved along with him in dusty waves. They took him to the pit. He lifted his head and saw that it was about 6 meters long and 3 meters wide. Across its length was the trunk of what had been a sturdy palm tree, secured on either end by piles of sandbags. He was able to have a look into the pit. By the light of the flickering torches, he saw it was about a meter and a half in depth and had a short ladder leaning against one side. At the bottom, some scurrying around and others sitting deathly still, were perhaps 300 scorpions. Pale brown ones, Michael noted. Those gave a nasty sting, but were not poisonous. He was pushed and dragged along to one end of the palm log, and standing there with his right hand on his broken shoulder, he saw Nuri take up position on the far end. Nuri motioned to the crowd.
Devil! Have we a contest?
Nuri stepped out onto the palm log. His balance was sure. He was grinning broadly.
Devil! Meet us in the middle! Have us, what call you, a cheerio little war? Me, king of all devils, you spit-faced fool. Has devil no brave?
The devil has brave.
Ah, then where?
Nuri gave a signal. One of the men picked up a clay jar and upturned it over the pit, and venomous black scorpions by the dozens began to slide out. Nuri reached under his robes and brought out in his left hand the knife with the curved blade. The right hand gripped a piece of iron pipe with a half dozen short chains attached to its end and a nail fixed in the end of every chain.
Come, devil! Come! Come!
With extreme caution and in no particular hurry, Michael walked out foot over foot above the scorpion pit.
Come, devil! Come! Come!
Michael dodged the chains, but now the knife was driving in at his thigh. Michael ignored the graze, stepped into Nuri and headbutted him. Michael caught Nuri's wrist and held it. They stared at each other, man against man. Nuri reared his right arm back to strike with the chains, and Michael knew the time had come. He opened the soul cage just a crack to let some of it free. His hand, holding Nuri's wrist, rippled and began to change. Within seconds, the hand had darkened with hair. It had altered its shape, and its fingers had curved into the claws of a killer. Black wolf hair ran like strange vines up his arm, twining around and around. A shadow seemed to pass over Michael's face, and from its darkness emerged the maw of the wolf. The green eye that was not a swollen slit glaring without mercy into Nuri's face. The wolf's new and bleeding fangs promising agony upon agony. Or at the very least, the devil's own justice. Michael Gallatin balanced not only on the palm log, but between worlds. The werewolf's green eye peered into Nuri's face and saw the horror become madness. It happened in the stutter of a heartbeat. Saliva bubbled from Nuri's mouth and dribbled down his chin. His eyes were scorched. He had truly seen behind the devil's mask, and now he was destroyed. Michael let him go. Then the crowd of once gleeful Dalasifa turned and fled for their lives. Gant and the boy had obviously found the correct tent. Michael edged back from the wild just as he edged back along the palm log, and by the time his boots touched earth, he was once more only a man. The village seemed to be empty. Maybe the Dalasifa would stop running when they reached Cairo, or when they ran across the nearest minefield. Michael walked toward the tent that was burning brightly. In the glow of the flames, two figures were approaching, one tall, one small.
My God! What the devil did you do?
Exactly that.
Exactly what?
Never mind. We better be careful. I think everyone's gone but for the watchman and three men who went out to look for you. Give me a gun.
Gant started to give him the Colt and then suddenly paused. The German flyer had both pistols. He was weak and unsteady, but he was still in control of his senses. Michael knew what he was thinking.
You'll have to kill me.
A fine pistol, but not of German quality.
He put the Colt into Michael's outstretched hand. The three of them walked through the village toward the waterhole.
I suppose I won't ask.
Ask what?
What you really did to frighten everyone out of here. I suppose I won't ask. And I suppose I really don't want to know.
He gave Michael a sidelong glance, and Michael wondered if one of his fingers had not entirely been changed back when he'd first offered his hand to take the Colt. No, no, of course not. But he was so very tired. No, of course not. They were almost to the waterhole when a figure on crutches emerged from between two tents and aimed the pistol he had somehow gotten hold of. First he aimed the gun at Michael, but something on the boy's firelit face and in the eyes that glittered with such venomous hate said it was useless to shoot the devil. So he altered his hand toward Gant. Hasid was already hobbling on his crutches into the shadows, his cloven hoof tossing up a spray of sand. In another few seconds, the fireman's son was gone.
Verdammen! The Allerstieses!
Michael knelt beside him. Gant had both hands pressed to his midsection. The blood was rising on the front of his shirt.
Move your hands.
Any fool can see I am going to die.
Not if I can find a medical kit.
Save your strength. Are you a surgeon? No. As they say, ich bin kaputt.
Moving with painful slowness, he withdrew the Walther from his waistband. Michael offered no help, thinking Gant was still capable of his own actions.
German quality. Cannot be bested.
Can you protect yourself while I get you some water?
I can. But it's very interesting, Michael. I am no longer thirsty. Please, go ahead. For both of you.
In the second tent he entered, he found a suitable water vessel, a German canteen stamped with the palm tree and Nazi symbol seal of the Afrika Korps. He went into several others in search of a medical kit, but had no luck. He walked on to the waterhole. He got on his knees, cupped his hand, and drank. Then he filled the canteen full, then took the canteen and walked back the route he'd come. He knew he couldn't give Gant any water. The stomach cramps would only add to the man's agony. And without professional medical attention, Gant was, as he'd said, kaput. So, all he could do now was make Gant as comfortable as possible and keep him company. He'd known stomach wounds like this to kill a man within an hour or so, and on the other end of that, a man might linger for a day or more. It was, after all, up to fate. After a while, Michael got up and went searching through the nearby tents for a medical kit. He found a box of British bandages and a box of Italian condoms, but not an ampule of morphine. He took the bandages and was able to pack Gant's wounds while the man slept. The front of Gant's shirt was a bloody mess. The two bullet holes were spaced about 4 inches apart, and the slugs were still in his intestines. At last, the sky began to lighten to the east. It was the beginning of another day. Red shards of sunlight burst from behind a mountain range. The shadows shrank. The heat began to grow. Michael leaned forward to check Gant's pulse, and the man's eyes opened.
I'm not dead.
Gant felt the bandages.
Nice work. Oh, it's getting light.
Hot day is coming.
Is there any other... in the desert? Scheiße! Die verletzt! I'm all right now. Michael.
Yes?
I want to apologize for the destruction of your aircraft. I would not have wished to have shut down an unarmed plane. It was not chivalrous.
I think chivalry has nothing to do with war.
True, but there is the ideal. In any case, sir, I apologize.
It was your duty.
Yes. That. I have always loved The dawn. The cleanest air, you see. The aircraft performs best at the dawn. Oh, Michael. You should have been with me up there.
With you? Or against you?
With me? Oh, you wouldn't have lasted an instant against me. Did I tell you? My count is now 46. No, that's not right. 50, I think. Yes, 50.
An impressive number.
Did we ever find water?
Yes, we did.
Sehr gut. You English, playing at war with your tea breaks. Your... what was that? Aftershave lotion. Oh, my. Well, you shall go down to defeat, smelling like gentlemen. For that, I salute you.
Many thanks.
Gant held up his arm and began to remove his wristwatch.
What are you doing?
This. I want you to have it.
I can't take that.
If you don't, they will.
Michael accepted the watch.
I will take care of
it. You'd better. It's come such a long way. Michael.
Yes?
We men of action must never stop trying. Eh?
Never.
Good man.
Michael felt it and saw the empty stare in the man's eyes, and when he checked the pulse and heartbeat, he verified what he already knew. The famous Messerschmitt ace, the shining example to German youth, the celebrity, the great lover, the man of action, the hero, was gone. Michael put the Breitling in his pocket. There was no need to bury Gant. The Dalasifa would just dig up the body. But it was only a suit of flesh, and the bird had flown. It was time to find another 2 or 3 canteens, fill them up, and find a way back home. The boy motioned him to the camel corral. Michael had no idea how to handle one of those creatures, how to saddle them up and get the bridle set. But fortunately, the boy did, and he was very efficient about it. They wet cloths and wrapped them around their heads and faces. They hung the canteens by leather cords from the saddles. They headed off in the direction they'd come, the boy leading the way on his camel and Michael just along for the ride. On the second morning, with a hard, hot wind blowing from the southwest, the two riders came across a platoon of soldiers escorted by a pair of tanks. The soldiers wore British khaki, and the tanks were Matilda's. When Michael had made the platoon's lieutenant understand who he was and where he'd come from, he and the boy were placed on one of the tanks and driven to a small air base called Al-Masir, about 20 kilometers to the east. The base had a hospital. It wasn't much, but they had soft beds and cooling palm frond fans that turned at the ceiling. Michael's broken shoulder was set and put into a cast, and his cuts swabbed with iodine. He decided not to look into any mirrors for a while, because he'd seen the expression on the face of the young and attractive brunette nurse. On the morning of the fifth day, two officers in clean uniforms with polished buttons arrived at the base in a Douglas Dakota transport plane. Michael knew one of them as the man sometimes called Mallory, who wore a colonel's insignia. It was explained to him that it was imperative he return to Cairo. It was explained to him that he could fly back with them in the Dakota, or, if his recent experience had somewhat sullied his desire for air travel, he might be driven in a truck back to HQ in Cairo. Of course, there was a very large difference in travel time between plane and truck, but it was his decision. Not to put any pressure on him, of course. Michael drew from his pocket a wristwatch. He examined its face only briefly. It was the plain brown leather band that drew his attention. He thought of the old planes of the Great War and how they were put together with wires, fabric, leather, and wood. How also they were taken up, as flimsy as they were, into the huge sky by small men with large dreams and the bravery of giants. He ran his fingers across the brown leather. They were still brave giants in those cockpits. Maybe it was time for him to grow a little larger, too.
I'll fly.
The room at the bottom of the stairs. When Michael Gallatin could force himself to meet his own eyes in the mirror, he opened the flawless silver case that lay atop the blue porcelain sink. It was monogrammed in simple capital letters with an H and a J. He removed from the case the two pieces of the Solingen travel razor. He put a fresh blade into its resting place and screwed the pieces of the razor together to make a hole. A gentleman must be well-groomed, and so, with just a few seconds' decision to employ no lather, he began to shave the stubble from his right cheek. On the first stroke, his hand betrayed him. He went too deep, felt first the nick and then the heat of blood rising from the cut on his cheekbone. Michael watched the drop of blood roll down through the small hairs toward his jawline. Another followed, and then a third. They smelled of blood sausages in the Paris market, fresh after midnight. He was hungry, roused to appetite by his own juices. But he continued to shave, stroke after stroke, some smooth, some ragged. And when he was done with the massacre of his face, he began to shave his throat and down across his chest, cleaving the field of black and gray hair, cutting himself here and there, no matter at all, for this little pain was nothing. And what would his Russian family think of him if he could not stand a little pain? When he finished this task, he was going to have to decide what to do about the dead woman in the bed. So he kept shaving, and he kept cutting, here and there, but this little pain was nothing. He regarded the first nick he'd made on his right cheek and thought he fully understood his problem. He had certainly gone too deep. So he stood in this bathroom, in room number 214 of the Hotel Grand Frederick, with its gold-colored walls and blue porcelain and its matching gold and blue tiles on the floor, and he dripped blood from seven cuts and mused on how his odor of wounded weakness would have had him torn to pieces in a certain area of Russian wilderness very distant from this dying city of Berlin. They would have consumed him, eaten his lungs and heart and all the meat that meant life for the strong, and they would have left his bones for the little scavengers who hid in the rotten logs, and all would be right with the world. Michael Gallatin, born Mikhail Galatinov in St. Petersburg 34 years ago, was no longer sure he was fit. Nothing had changed about him except for the slips of the razor. Except for the haze in his eyes, the tightness of his mouth. He was lean and healthy. His shoulders were broad and his waist narrow, and he had enough muscle to get his work done. His thick hair was black, streaked with gray at the temples and cut short in the military style. Across his left cheek was a scar that began just under the eye and continued back into the hairline, the gift of a would-be assassin in North Africa in 1942. He bore other scars, nothing too ghastly, nothing that could not be explained to a woman between the damp sheets, with her head leaning against his shoulder and her fingers wandering the fields of his flesh, as the demands of a soldier. He was going to have to go and look at her again. He steeled himself for it, but his metal had become tin. He wondered, as he put the bloodied razor away into the beautiful silver case she'd bought for him 2 days ago, if after he drank the last glass of champagne and put on his uniform of a German major, he should set fire to the bed and send her to Valhalla in the proper fashion. It had begun barely a month ago, when Michael had returned from an early morning run through the cold January sleet of Wales and found a black Bentley Mark V in front of his proudly isolated house. At its wheel waited the older man Michael knew as Mallory. They drove along the tracks that passed as roads, and sleet slashed across the windshield.
The inner ring has been penetrated.
Michael knew, of course, about the inner ring. The group of Germans who were still doggedly fighting Hitler and the Nazis from within. They were scientists who did their best to delay or sabotage weapons projects. secretaries and aides who made notes on overheard conversations or intercepted messages. More than one railway dispatcher who sent a munitions train onto a track laid with explosives. A priest or two who kept a radio tuned to the British Secret Service wavelength and a codebook hidden where only Christ might find it. Prostitutes and pickpockets, old white-haired soldiers who carried scars from the First Great War, and ordinary citizens with extraordinary courage who had come over to the hope that Germany would surrender to the British or Americans and that it would happen before the Russian wave smashed over the crumbling rock of the fatherland.
A woman has penetrated the ring. She has seduced her way in. Her name is Franziska Luxa. She's a photographer and a journalist for Signal.
Signal magazine, as Michael also knew, was the glossy, lavishly illustrated propaganda magazine of the German armed forces, enjoyed at the height of its popularity by over 2 million readers.
The ring is being taken apart, person by person. They are disappearing into the Gestapo headquarters in Berlin. Fräulein Luxe is a bit of a... I would call her a huntress. She's gotten on the scent of the ring through a stupid, love-stricken man, and she's working with a Gestapo official named Axel Rittenkret to uncover and destroy, a kind way to put it, every member of the ring and their families. Out of 100 or so, there are maybe 50 left. We've been helping as many as we can, but some have complications and can't get out. Some refuse to leave. They consider themselves martyrs for a cause. This is why you're needed.
I knew it was coming to that.
We're trying our best to get everyone out. We won't be fully successful, but we need time. And we need you, Major, to give Franziska Luxa something to think about, other than tracking down members of the ring and sending them to be tortured to death at the hands of the Gestapo. Do you understand the mission?
Go into the chaos of Berlin, masquerade as a German, an officer, most likely, and a man with an interesting backstory, to seduce a rather nasty female Nazi? I'm flattered, but I believe there are other men who would be better suited for this job.
Read her dossier there in the briefcase. She's 30 years old and quite beautiful. She's a champion skier, an expert marksman, and driver of racing cars, as well as being fluent in French, Italian, and English. Her father was a daredevil pilot who ended his life last year testing a new German jet aircraft. Her mother, at 17, was a circus lion tamer, has been an Olympic swimmer, and a member of the most recent German expedition to Antarctica in 1938. Here now, what's this?
Mallory put his foot to the brake and stopped the car.
I presume that's one of your companions standing in the road? Am I in some kind of violation I need to know about?
A precaution. No one can take me beyond this point without my agreement. And theirs also.
My God, that's a big one. May I ask...
Animal. As far as I know, there is no one else like me.
One never knows what the Germans, if not stopped, might try to create in their laboratories. Oh my. That didn't sound right. Forgive me. It is very important that you do this. The German army is reeling back from the Ardennes in the aftermath of Operation Wacht am Rhein.
Divisions would be refitting, restaffing, and waiting for further orders. There would be some confusion to take advantage of. This mission involved no parachute jump, just a truck trip in the company of British commandos and a river to be crossed at night by rubber raft. On the other side would be some soldiers of the Inner Ring to get him into Berlin by staff car. He would have a solid identity, papers made by someone who made real papers, and a safe house to go to if things went wrong. He would be contacted as to when to end the mission and leave the same way. What made him so valuable was that he knew his way around Berlin.
All measured out. So simple in theory. I understand the capture of the Bridget Arnhem was also a simple theory.
Michael expected no response on that one, and got none.
How am I supposed to meet Franziska Luxa?
I said the German army was reeling back, and there's confusion to be used in our favor. I said nothing about the end of parties and merrymaking in Berlin, did I? Can I count on you?
A river to be crossed, and leave the same way.
But it occurred to Michael that no river could be crossed twice by the same man, because the river was never exactly the same, and neither would be the man. Michael Gallatin walked out of the bathroom, stood over the bed, and stared at her body. The lights flickered. a power interruption somewhere in the grid. Did she move in that brief loss of light? Did she stretch her long, taut legs and open her own smoldering, gray-hued eyes?
Come to bed again, darling. Come crush me into thine and drink all of me, every drop.
She did not. Dressed in his uniform as a German major of the 25th Panzer Reconnaissance Battalion, 25th Panzer Grenadier Division, Michael had seen her across the dance floor at the Grand Frederick's Regal Room. It was his third night in Berlin, and this party was his reason for booking a room at the hotel. Michael watched her move amidst the men and other women like a torch flame amidst sad candles. And as he sipped from his glass of 1936 French Armagnac, the glint of her eyes, for the briefest of seconds, passed across him, and he felt the quick, exhilarating celebration of being noted, like a knight on his knees before a queen. He went to her.
Pardon me, but you are nearly the most beautiful woman I have ever seen.
She just stared into his eyes for perhaps 3 seconds. 3 very long seconds. Her red lips parted.
Nearly?
Well, I haven't seen all of you yet.
He hadn't known what he was going to say until it was time to speak, but as these words passed through the air, she lifted her chin, almost as if to taste them.
Pardon me.
She did not follow, nor did she track him very long with her gaze. Instead, she returned to her conversation. A slender young woman in a black dress, her hair red with coppery highlights, and her face lovely, if a little vapid, drifted out from the dance floor and came directly toward Michael, offering him her cigarette to light. He'd picked up a packet of matches from the lobby for just such a moment. 10 flimsy matches to the pack, the chemicals being in such shortage. Yet the cigarette smokers were legion. Michael struck a match and held it out. And as the red-haired woman grasped his hand to guide the flame, a breeze blew from the southeastern quadrant. The match went dark, and a hand took the cigarette from the woman's lips.
Go back to your husband, Berta.
Franziska Luxe put the cigarette into Berta's hand and closed the white fingers around it.
He's about to be cornered by the most infamous homosexual in the room.
Berta left, drifting along like someone who was already dead but didn't know it.
There. I just saved you from a boring encounter with a nymphomaniac.
Thank you.
I am Franziska Luxa. I'm a photographer and writer for Signal. You may have seen my work.
Possibly. I haven't had much time for the reading of magazines.
You're a major. Reconnaissance?
That was clear by the badge. His Iron Cross was also on full display. Now came what she really desired to know.
What's your name?
Horst Jaeger, Fräulein. At your service.
Why do you presume I'm not married? I could have chosen to leave my ring at home tonight.
No German husband would not be cleaved to the side of a woman like yourself.
Really? Why is that?
To protect her from men like me.
I need no protection. I'm interested in you. Major Jaeger, have you ever been professionally photographed?
He returned a quizzical expression.
My intent is a photographic piece on the faces of the noble warriors, those who haven't surrendered in your heart. I can tell in this room who has surrendered in the heart and who has not. No, I'm not saying that anyone here is a coward or a doomsayer or treasonous, but there is a difference between the noble warrior who still believes in the German future and the rabble, whether they wear uniforms with polished gold buttons or not.
Michael was impressed by her intensity. She was standing right in front of him now, filling up his vision, completing it in a way. She was almost 6 feet tall, and he'd already seen her heels were not very high. In her eyes lay a controlled wildness, a calm before the storm. He thought her fierce beauty was breathtaking, almost otherworldly, and he had to remind himself that he was here in enemy territory on a very dangerous and important mission, and the smallest mistake, the smallest slip of accent or attitude, could end his life before the stroke of midnight.
I'm not sure I'm so noble.
And an essence of humility, too. My God, where have you been?
Now, who is this, Franziska? An uninvited guest, I think.
It was the birthday boy, in company with the 2 men who'd been conversing with Fräulein Luxe when Michael had first approached. Both the men wore dark suits with swastika lapel pins, white shirts, and dark ties. One man was husky, with a frizz of curly black hair and the sunken eyes of a common thug, while the other wore wire-framed spectacles and had thinning reddish-brown hair and the look of a worried accountant who had misplaced the key to his master's deposit box. The birthday boy, however, was a formidable presence. In his polar white suit, his shoulders looked to be 5 feet broad, and he was easily as tall as Michael, at about 6'2". He had a little snow cap of white hair atop the mountain peak of his head, his hair cropped right to the scalp, sandy and sparkly on the sides, and presumably also on the back. He had the round face and full cheeks of a cherub, a boyish grin on his wide mouth, and pale blue eyes that did not quite complement the grin.
You're absolutely right, sir. I'm staying here and was passing when I heard the music. I don't know anyone here, but I thought...
You'd walk in and help yourself to a drink or two, Major, at my birthday party? That takes some cheek, sir.
I didn't know. No one stopped me at the door.
There's a sign on the door that says private party. Did you not see that? What's your name and your division?
His name is Horst Jaeger. He's a friend of mine, Axel.
A friend? Of how long? 5 minutes? Your papers, please.
Michael cocked his head to one side.
I'll see your papers first, sir.
You wish to see my papers? My papers?
I know who I am. I have no idea who you might be.
A hand plunged down into an inner pocket of a white jacket. It returned, gripping a leather wallet covered with white horsehair.
I am Axel Rittenkret, senior investigator with the...
The wallet opened to display the square brass badge with the German eagle stamped above the Nazi swastika, and along the bottom the words, Geheime Staatspolizei.
As you seem to disregard plain writing, Major, I will tell you that this is all the paper I need to put you in a car in the next moment and carry you with great glee to Gestapo headquarters.
Herr Rittenkret, I have been with the 25th Panzer Grenadier Division since France in 1940. My companions and I were sent to the Russian front in 1941. We fought at Minsk, Kiev, in the blizzards before Moscow, over the minefields at Kursk, and through the inhuman butcheries at Smolensk. We fought our way out of the encirclement of Army Group Center with heavy loss. We were sent to the Western Front after the invasion. Undermanned in the hedgerows with mostly green replacements. Most recently, was it just in December? We were holding the beach sector in the Ardennes. Herr Rittenkret, I appreciate the weight and power of your Gestapo badge, but I have seen men gutted, disemboweled, beheaded, cut in half, reduced to gibbering torsos that beg for death, crushed flat and unrecognizable as anything ever human under tank treads, blown into glistening shreds by artillery shells, burned alive by flamethrowers, and worse, not completely burned alive by flamethrowers. Frozen solid in snowbanks. Killed in ridiculous accidents by comrades too bone-weary to check their weapons. And drowned crossing rivers because they were too proud to tell their sergeants they never learned to swim. I have seen a young man turn 80 years old in a matter of minutes. I have seen the handsome pride of a loving mother lose his face like a mask being torn away. So much garbage for the summer flies. So, Herr Rittenkret, I appreciate your position, and I congratulate you on your birthday. But I'm expecting to be ordered eastward again any day now, with the 25th Panzer Grenadiers for the glory of the Reich. And so until then, I will walk through any door I please, and take any drink I please, because, Herr Rittenkret, I walk and drink in the company of many hundreds of ghosts. And we have earned that very small privilege. Even from the Gestapo.
And though Herr Rittenkret did not move an inch, Michael felt him draw back.
I have one question for you, Major. Answer it very carefully.
Go ahead, sir.
Rittenkret's snow-capped head nodded. One hand slowly came up to grip Michael's right shoulder. The blue eyes crinkled.
Would you like ice cream with your cake?
Yes, I would.
Ross, go get it for him.
The thuggish Nazi moved to obey.
I suppose it's unnecessary to surmise that you've given back to the enemy double or triple what you and your brave comrades have endured. No answer needed there, I can see for myself. Otherwise, you wouldn't be alive, yes? Franziska, why isn't our new friend a colonel?
I was going to ask him the same question.
There are already many talented and able colonels. I prefer to be near the action.
Ah, spoken like a man who ought to be a colonel. Your accent, is it...
Westphalian. My hometown is Dortmund.
I have some dealings involving the Hadamar Hospital there. A shame your fair city has taken so much damage from the bombers. But that will be reckoned with very soon. I presume you were here last night during the air raid?
I was, yes.
Prepare for more. But don't fear. Our courageous Luftwaffe is steadily rebuilding. I know of some tricks up their sleeves yet to come.
I don't fear. If the Führer says it will happen, so it shall.
Exactly. But in the meantime, Major, make sure you get your ass to the cellar when you hear those sirens.
The thug entered with a plate of cake and ice cream and both a fork and spoon engraved with the name of the hotel. As Michael accepted the gift and wondered where he was going to dump the sugary stomach clogger, the man who looked like a distressed accountant whispered something into Rittenkret's ear, and the big red-faced man grimaced.
Well, Sigmund reminds me I have business to tend to even on the night of my own party. Franziska, I'm sure you will be in your element as a gracious hostess in my absence. Oh, our continuing project requires your special enthusiasm. Your invaluable communication skills. We have some new clients on the list. Shall we talk in my office tomorrow morning, around 9 o'clock?
Absolutely.
She warms my cockles. Major Jaeger, eat and drink to your heart's delight and walk through any door that pleases you. It was an honor to meet you. Good luck and good... I'm sure you must hear this quite a lot. Hunting. Heil Hitler.
Heil Hitler.
The white, mountainous shape of the Gestapo investigator and his two assistants moved away through the throng.
Interesting man. May I ask, why the white suit in the winter?
His persona. He always wears a white suit, in every season. He likes to be called the Iceman.
The Iceman? Why is that?
You don't want to know. We've just met, but I have to say, you take a great chance speaking that way to someone like him.
I'd probably take a greater chance putting this in my stomach before bedtime.
Michael set the cake and ice cream on the tray of a passing waiter.
I mean it. Axel has two faces. You can never know which one is looking at you.
Meat.
What?
Oh, I am thinking aloud. I would like some meat. I believe the restaurant's still open across the lobby. Have you eaten dinner?
I should stay here.
No. You should not.
Even though supplies were running low, the chef was doing the best he could, and the grilled lamb chops in the Königlicher Garten were excellent. Franziska grazed on a salad.
Your accent is strange. I've met people from Westphalia before. Your accent, it's different somehow.
Accents are as different as people, I suppose.
I suppose.
I have a question. As a signal photographer and journalist, what project are you working on with the Gestapo?
We are both soldiers. You have your battlefields and I have mine, because we both love Germany and the Reich. What more is there for us?
Life.
His response stunned him momentarily because he didn't know where it came from.
The battle is life.
A few minutes later, he had eaten his way to the bones, and now he pushed his plate aside. Without looking at her, he could feel her like his own heartbeat. Her eyes were on him. They were taking him to pieces, even as he sat wondering what he should say next.
I'm not a whore, and I'm not sorry for you. If you are ordered to go east tomorrow morning or the day after, that is your purpose. What I told you at the first is true. I'd like to photograph you for my article. Why? You are a very handsome man. You would look good on a magazine cover. And as I said, I know you have a strong and noble heart. How do I know that? Because even though you and I are both aware we desire to go to your room and make love tonight, you're not rushing me there like an animal. I would go with you, regardless if you were all claws and spittle, because I do want the photograph. But because you are not an animal, I will go with you, gladly, and in great anticipation of learning what you think of all of me.
I might turn into an animal the instant the door is locked.
I'm counting on that.
Minutes later, they were in his room. Franziska wore the expression of someone in a dream world that could not be shared, her lips slightly parted and teeth gleaming, her gaze upon him hungry, yet not to be hurried through this banquet. He moved his hands over her like a sculptor, warming the smooth, sleek stone before its transformation. She was harder than other women he'd known, her breasts small, but the nipples yearning for his touch and taste. He slid his fingers along her sides, feeling the ribs there and all the constructions of sinew, bone, and flesh that held the soul at its center. He let the knuckles of his right hand glide slowly down her stomach. His fingers reached and lingered upon the black triangle of hair between long thighs that had begun almost imperceptibly to tremble. Michael cupped the back of Franziska's neck with his left hand, and as he drew her face to him, she put a finger against his chin, and the message was clear.
You do not have my permission for that.
So he picked her up in his arms and took her to the bed. He longed to enter her, to join himself with her in the only way he could, and she longed for it also because she pressed herself, moist with excitement, against him. Yet he had no intention of rushing the moment. He began a soft consumption of her, an exploration of her beautiful body with his tongue and small nips of the teeth. He spared no effort and missed no port of call. And when his journey was almost done, she shifted her hips and grasped his hair with both hands and called him back to revisit her aching harbor. Then it was her turn to travel. Michael Gallatin had known many excellent visitors, with many outstanding and often amazing talents. But Franziska Luxa very easily could be awarded the key to his city, if not his world. Her mouth was larger than he could have imagined, and her tongue more heated. She was a relentless lover, a force that went nearly too far, backed off again, and again pushed the limit of his endurance. When at last he pushed himself inside her, she took him deeply and wrapped her legs like bands of fire around his hips. They rocked together upon the wrecked sheets. He saw colors behind his eyes that had no description and were blinding even in his darkness. Then he opened his eyes to drink in her beauty and found her glistening face looking up at him with wonder, as a solitary traveler through many black nights might look upon a guiding star. She mounted him while he lay on his back. It had always been his belief that one could tell how passionate in bed a woman was by the way she danced, by her innate sense of rhythm and her daring to experiment with the music she heard in her soul. It went on, wave after wave, until he was emptied. Franziska clung to him through her own series of small deaths, and in her rebirth melded her cheek against his. They lay side by side with their heads on the same pillow, staring at each other. Her fingers caught with his, and her thighs held between his own.
What can I say?
What would you like to say?
Something unladylike.
There's no one listening but me, and I know you're a lady.
You make me very, 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 very horny.
Which was music to his ears. The second time they made love was slower and softer. They were both tired, but both eager and willing to drive themselves and each other into the realm of dazed insensibility. Around 3 in the morning, they showered together and were slick and soapy when the warm water abruptly turned icy cold.
Scheiße!
Oh, the time! Oh!
She went up on her tiptoes as he put the towel between her legs from behind and gave her a little buzz of friction.
You'd better be careful.
Or what?
You keep this up, I'll have to stay with you all day, just so you won't get into trouble.
If you want me to keep it up, just ask.
Michael glanced southward.
A growing boy does require breakfast.
I think you should get some sleep. And I should go home too, sad to say.
Sad to say, so don't say it.
I can't stay. Really, I have some work to do this morning. I have to be clear-headed.
Am I now a noxious fog?
I'm serious, Horst. I would love to stay and have breakfast with you and do whatever you'd like, but I...
Hey, I've been cut calls.
Yes, he does. And I wish you would forget you ever met him or heard him speak to me. This is something you don't need to be concerned about.
Which makes me more concerned than before. Is it dangerous?
She pulled away from him and stepped back into the bedroom. She began to get dressed and studiously avoided his stare. He sat on the bed and watched her. God, she was some piece of fabulous woman. Suddenly she looked up at him.
Oh, you've got the face of a wounded puppy. Get some sleep. You'll feel better in a few hours.
I doubt it. But thank you anyway.
Of course you'll feel better. Or I hope you will. Because I'm going to cut my meeting short. Tell Herr Rittenkret what he wants to hear, and then I can take the rest of the day to show you something I think you'll really like. Will you do my buttons?
It dawned on Michael what she was saying. He buttoned her up and placed his hands on both globes of her bottom, tight in the saucy red dress.
I've already seen something I really like.
Oh, look at you now. A wolf where a puppy just was.
Yes, that's me. Won't our Gestapo friend take offense at your, shall I say, unprofessional attitude today?
It's a meeting to make plans, that's all. Now, I've said enough about that, and you've asked enough questions, honestly.
When Franziska was ready to go, Michael unlocked the door for her. Before he could turn the cut glass knob, she placed her hand on his.
I am never unprofessional. Not when I'm working, or when I'm involved in a project. We won't talk about this anymore. If you'll be downstairs in front of the hotel at 10:30, I'll come for you.
In public?
A naughty little laugh wanted so much to spring from her mouth. A muscle in her jaw moved to clench it shut, but her eyes were sparkling.
You are part gentleman and all beast.
She pushed him playfully on the chest, and then she opened the door for herself. He lay on the bed for a while, but it smelled too much like her. She was even still in his own freshly washed skin and hair. He would have to cut his nose off if he wanted to be rid of her.
A rather nasty female Nazi.
He remembered saying that to Mallory. Well, she was. He'd done his damnedest, but he hadn't stopped her from going to see Rittenkret. Maybe he was responsible for the meeting being cut short, as she put it, but that didn't mean some member of the inner ring might not be picked up tonight. Her invaluable communications skills, Rittenkret had said. New clients on the list. Did that mean she was inserting herself into having affairs with suspected members of the ring to get information? So she might not be a whore for a single German officer, but she was indeed a whore for the entire Third Reich?
Oh my God. Michael, old chap. Jealous just a little bit, are we?
It was Michael's intention to be a few minutes late, standing out onto the Kleiststrasse in front of the hotel. Yet he found himself leaving the Grand Frederick a few minutes early. He wore his perfect counterfeit uniform, his cap and boots, a Feldgrau overcoat, and black leather gloves. It was a chilly morning, though the sky was blue and the sun bright. He was staring out at the city when a sleek silver Bayerische Motorenwerke 328 sports roadster slid out of the trickle of elderly black cars and cloak-wrapped citizens on bicycles and stopped in front of him. It was a convertible. The top was down, and Franziska Luxe sat behind the wheel with a gray woolen cap pulled jauntily over her hair and green-tinted pilot's goggles on her face, though the glass windshield was up, both for driver and passenger.
Aha! In the style of the Silver Arrows.
Exactly. Get in. I'll take you for a ride.
Franziska put the white-knobbed gear shift into first, tapped the accelerator, and they were off along the Kleiststrasse like a silver swan amid the waddling somber geese. He was glad she had the good sense to be wearing a fawn-colored overcoat and brown driving gloves. She kept increasing the speed, shifting through the gears with an expert hand. Franziska whipped to the right on Mochstrasse. Her foot descended on the accelerator again. Michael held his breath as they passed through a flurry of bicyclists and they sped along toward the southwest.
Your car? Or a friend's?
Mine! All mine! I was part of the Grand Prix Mercedes-Benz team in 39. This was as close as I could get to a silver arrow for the road.
Michael nodded. The story was that in 1934, prior to a Grand Prix race at the Nürburgring, a competing Mercedes tested 1 kilogram over the limit on the weight scales. So the racing manager and driver at that time removed all the white paint from the car to lose the offending kilo. The next day, the shining silver car won the race, and the legend was born. Between 1934 and 1939, all the great German racing cars of Mercedes-Benz and Auto Union were bare silver, and all were referred to as silver arrows. Franziska and Michael arrowed along through the city.
My studio's over there.
She pointed to a concentration of gable-roofed buildings to the right. Not a minute afterward, she turned off the avenue and began a twisty tour that took them across cobblestone streets not suited for speed. And as Michael had already seen the haze of smoke and dust in the air, he knew she was trying to avoid the bombed-out sections. It was an impossible task because there had been so many bombs. She didn't speak while they were driving through or around these sections, and neither did Michael. He wanted to ask her how she was getting the fuel and oil to operate this buggy, since for every car he saw, there were a half dozen wagons and a dozen more bicycles. But he decided it was not a prudent question. The clusters of buildings thinned to outskirts. Suddenly they came upon a checkpoint with a lowered gate and 4 soldiers with machine guns. Franziska showed one of the men a small booklet with a yellow cover stamped by the Nazi swastika. He opened it briefly to look at something, and then the booklet was returned to her, the gate opened, and the 328 shot through onto what Michael realized was the Führer's pride, the Reichsautobahn. It was 4 lanes of white concrete separated by a grassy median about 5 meters wide. It stretched on across the rolling winter-brown landscape like a ski trail, which Michael thought touched 2 of Franziska's interests, both involving speed. As far as he could see, and he could see very far, today the Reichsautobahn belonged to her and her alone.
Do you like to go fast?
I do. When do we start?
They went into curves that Michael was certain they could never take at this speed, yet they were kept on the concrete by Franziska's undeniable skill with the clutch, gear shift, and quick taps of the brake. They hurtled onward.
You're very quiet.
I'm enjoying the ride.
He expected she'd be turning back before long. He intended to ask her where he might take her to lunch, and after that, he would say he wanted to see her studio, and maybe this afternoon, if she was willing, to get the photographs done. After that, if she was willing... His reverie on matters of the bedroom was interrupted by a quick glint of metal, up in the sky, at about the 2 o'clock position. The hills and trees obscured his vision on the right. Then they curved to the left and started upward, and at the top of the rise, the pair of aircraft, one following off to the side of the other, shrieked about 50 feet above their heads. The 2 planes were P-51 Mustangs, marked with American stars. Michael saw that the aircraft in the rear position carried 4 air-to-ground rockets. As Franziska returned her attention to the roadway and her fingers tightened on the wheel, Michael saw the 2 planes begin to turn to the right.
I think we better get off this.
The first Mustang was straightening out and coming in for the kill. Franziska hit the brake. She whipped the wheel around and the BMW fishtailed and spun in a circle that left a perfect O of black rubber.
Hang on!
When Michael got his neck working again and looked over his shoulder, he saw the 2 angels of death turning for another pass. Franziska didn't look. She just drove, now jinking the BMW to left and right, refusing to give the planes an easy target. She suddenly swerved the wheel to the right. They crossed the median onto the other pair of lanes. 2 rows of Browning bullets rushed after them. The second pilot had eased back on the throttle, and Michael knew he was lining up a shot. Franziska hit the brake, violently downshifted, and fought the wheel to veer again over the median to the other side. Michael lost sight of the planes. An onrush of panic seized him. He twisted around. The Mustangs were coming down side by side like vultures, almost floating toward them, wingtip to wingtip. Michael sensed Franziska trying to decide what to do. He saw her grasp the gear knob to shift down. She was going to stomp the brake and make the Mustangs overshoot. Michael made his own decision. He reached out and pulled the cap off Franziska's head, letting the ebony hair boil out and stretch behind her like a banner. She looked at him from the green-tinted goggles as if she thought he'd gone stark raving mad. The two Mustangs passed overhead, still side by side. Picking up speed, they waggled their wings. Then they turned to the right, and Michael watched them as they flashed away, silver bright and shining toward the west.
It's all right, they've gone!
They've gone? How do you know? And what was that with my cap?
I decided that no fighter pilot worth his wings would kill a woman in a sports roadster. But they had to see you were a woman.
At the top of the incline, Francisca downshifted, braked, and cut their speed. In the distance ahead of them was the smoke haze of the destruction in Berlin. Francisca eased the BMW to a stop in the road. Michael reached into his coat for the white handkerchief he always carried.
Let's do this.
Michael pushed the goggles up on her forehead. The tears in her eyes were, of course, from terror, but she was certainly a strong-hearted woman. He dabbed the tears away as gently as he could. If he wasn't supposed to be such a man, he might have shed a few himself. Even so, his hand wasn't exactly the steadiest it had ever been.
Now you know why scout cars aren't silver.
She stared at him blankly for a few seconds. Then all the fire and excitement rushed back into her eyes. What could be more funny than to be sitting in a fast roadster on the edge of Berlin with a beautiful Nazi Gestapo talent and the smell of rocket explosive in one's clothes? He suspected that at this minute, he'd become a little unhinged. She leaned toward him, took his cap off, and put her hand around the back of his neck. Her lips just barely grazed his own, but her mouth was ready to be crushed. She stayed at that intimate distance. Michael didn't try to breach the gap. He didn't yet have her permission, and he respected that. When she kissed him, it was soft. He kissed her back just as softly. Their lips met and held, and some trick of friction or cold air made them tingle together. Francisca pulled her head back and looked at him.
Oh, we'd better get off this road.
When she still hesitated, he had a bad instant in which he couldn't decide whether he'd spoken in German, Russian, or English. Then she nodded.
Yes, you're right.